So it's nice and hot again, and the body becomes uncomfortable, and so the mind says, ooh, I don't like it. So we have a perfect example of the mind reacting to the body, which is very helpful. And also, we have a very good example at the same time of difficulties we encounter with the body. Because if you were to imagine for a moment, and I'm sure everybody can imagine that, that you were strictly only mind, well, who would be feeling hot? The mind doesn't feel hot, it's the body that feels hot. And it's the mind reacting to it. So the body is not such a wonderful thing to have, and no reason that we should call it mine. It just happens to be this way for the human realm. That's the way it is. In the human realm, there's a body, and it's got to be dealt with in some manner or form, which we're all doing, apparently. More or less, huh? We're still on mindfulness of the body, and we're going to have one more explanation and one more contemplation also for the body. And it's particularly, I said already, it's particularly important, the body. The Buddha always mentions it first. And so there are many different ways of trying to get at the real understanding. And the Buddha calls the real understanding knowledge and vision of things as they really are. In Pali, that's Jata Bhuta Jnana Dasana. And that is an expression. It's a technical expression. Knowledge and vision of things as they really are. That expression denotes the moment when we see things differently. Differently from what they appear optically to be. Now, vision must not be misunderstood to be a visualization. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. Not everybody is visually inclined. Not everybody can actually have visualizations. It's not that common. The knowledge and vision actually means that we have, the knowledge is the experience that we have, the experiences, and the vision of it is the understanding of the experience. So it's the understood experience. It's the understood experience which means wisdom. It's the only thing that means wisdom. To understand our experiences. Now, obviously, everybody experiences the same things over and over again. Namely, that each breath that we take in or out is totally impermanent. And who thinks of it? When I talk about it, we think of it. We might read one of the discourses of the Buddha and think of it. And even we, who are practitioners, may never think of it otherwise. What about all these millions and millions of people who've never even heard of the Buddha? Do they think that their breath is very impermanent? At the moment when they lose it, when there's danger of death because of losing the breath, then they know it. But otherwise? And it's just as impermanent every single moment. So if we watch our breath, let's say, just outside of meditation, which is mindfulness of the body, because we're breathing, and we recognize the impermanence of each breath, then we have knowledge and vision of things as they really are, instead of just taking it all for granted and using our optics. Now, we're taking our breath for granted, usually, instead of, apart from meditation, then we don't take it for granted. But when we don't meditate, it's just the way things are, isn't it? But that it's totally impermanent doesn't seem to strike people at all until they're really confronted with that, and then they have to look if they want to. Now, this is what we're going to have today as the mindfulness of the body. We're going to use the 5 daily recollections, or 4 of them, not the karma one, we'll use that another time, which are concerned with impermanence. 4 of the daily recollections are concerned with impermanence. And so we first have a look, which I already have explained, at the breath which we're using for a meditation subject. And I've already said, and I like to repeat it, that if you can become concentrated and calm by watching the breath, there's no need to look at it as being impermanent. But if the mind is very unruly, it's very good to look at it as being impermanent. And then the mindfulness outside of meditation can be directed towards that, towards the impermanence of each breath. It's actually most interesting. Doesn't sound so interesting, does it? But it is. Because it's a totally different viewpoint. It's not something that people do. I dare say, maybe I'm wrong, but I dare say it's not something you usually do. And yet it's a thing to be done. Now the same applies to our movements. Now I've already mentioned that we should, outside of meditation, be aware of our movements. But now I'm adding to it, be aware of the impermanence of each movement. And that it has to be impermanent. Now, just take walking, for instance. I mean, you couldn't walk if each movement wasn't impermanent. You'd have to stand still for the rest of your life. And we can't. You know very well that it's very difficult to even remain in one position unless we are completely concentrated on our meditation subject, and then we don't notice it. But other than that, even at night, we might have a really good mattress and be, to all intents and purposes, be fast asleep. Yet, the body does become uncomfortable, and the mind notices that, even though we're asleep, and we keep turning and tossing. There's a rare person that will wake up in the same position that they went to sleep in. In fact, I don't know if anybody does. And if you look at your bed clothes and all the things that are on the bed, I mean, they don't look as if you haven't moved. Everything is usually in a tumble. The body can't remain in one place. It's too uncomfortable. Only when we're totally concentrated. Now, there you can also see that sleep and concentration are not the same thing for the mind. They do not do the same thing for the mind. Concentration renews energy. Concentration is like a rejuvenator for the mind, whereas sleep is a rejuvenator for the body and not for the mind. Most people like to go to sleep for the simple reason that they can then stop thinking, pondering, worrying, hoping, projecting, remembering. And they think that that will be helpful to their peace of mind. Well, it is to a very small extent. Because the mind reacts to the body, as I've already explained, and it also dreams. So to a small extent, the mind is a bit relieved of its constant work, but not to the extent that it will be rejuvenated, has new energy, will be strong. The body does, but not the mind. So what the body does when we are going to sleep, the mind needs to do in order to be rejuvenated, needs to concentrate. Concentrate to the exclusion of thinking. And to the exclusion of thinking is then also one of the possibilities that we don't feel the body at that time. We can actually sit still. But other than that, the body's got to move. And so when we are walking or we feel, now I've sat long enough, I want to get up, or I've stood long enough, I want to go somewhere, or I've gone long enough, I want to sit down again, or I want to lie down again. Don't take that for granted. Notice the body's restlessness, which translates into the mind as the wish for change. That's again knowledge and vision of things as they are, which we usually don't. Knowledge and vision of things as they are is, so to say, the first step that takes us into deep insight. And there are a lot of things we need to see differently. Everything that's connected with ourselves needs to be seen differently. It's like a children's kaleidoscope. All you have to do is make a slight movement and you get a totally different picture. Well, here too. One needs to make a slight movement with the mind and we get a totally different picture. And that slight movement that we need to make with the mind is from taking everything for granted the way it is to actually being a keen observer of it. Now, if you are a keen observer of your own walking, dressing, sitting, lying down, standing, and so on, you will notice in no time at all that there is practically constant movement. So that everything we do, everything that the body does, it's impermanent. The other thing that we have to notice and that we will notice, and there's no question that we can, is the movement that is inherent in the body itself. Now, we already talked about that, because the wind element is movement. But now we can also, in meditation or outside of meditation, we can be aware of this inner movement. This inner movement, if we become aware of it in meditation, can be a feeling of arising and ceasing, or one of dissolution. And what we feel there are all the particles of the body. We don't know that they're the particles, doesn't matter. But what we do know, and what is important to feel, is this movement. If we pay good attention, it's not difficult to notice movement within the body. It's not a movement which is comparable to taking a step. It's not a big and solid movement like that. It's small movements which can be compared to the, like for instance, the air that touches one from the fan. That's moving, but it's not a very solid movement. Well, the same thing is noticeable in the body itself. Knowing that, recognizing it for what it is, again, we see things as they really are. Now, we all know that the heart has to keep on beating. Maybe we can feel it. Well, it's got to move, hasn't it? It can't just take one beat and that's it. Finish. End of person. Beginning of corpse. It's got to do something. It's got to keep on moving. And the same with the blood. It's got to keep on moving. there's all sorts of possibilities of feeling this movement within the body. Now you can, we can use that as a contemplation, as a meditation, as a mindfulness outside of meditation, whenever it's possible to recognize. Now the other thing that we can also use to great advantage are our sense contacts. Now seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. We have five sense contacts. We're not going to talk about thinking because that comes with mindfulness of our mental formations. Now these five senses are based in the body. The eyes are part of the body, the ears are part of the body, taste buds are part of the body, smelling is part of the body, and certainly our touching. Touching the whole body is able to have touch contact. So all that's part of the body. Now, what we usually do and take for granted is that some of these sense contacts are tempting us into wanting to have them again because they're pleasant. And others are tempting us into becoming very negative because they're unpleasant. And that's all we know about them. And the result of that, and that's all anybody knows about them, unless they have practiced. The result of this very limited knowing, is that we spend a lot of time and a lot of energy in trying to get the pleasant sense contacts. Because the pleasant sense contact generates a pleasant feeling. And the pleasant feeling generates a positive reaction. So we want to have it pleasant. As far as the body is concerned, we like to have it comfortable, but not just. We'd like to have it more than comfortable. We'd like to have it really pleasant. And this is actually what the whole world does all the time. Our whole human economy and all our main diversions and also main commercial enterprises are based on this fact, which of course nobody knows, because nobody has knowledge and vision of things as they really are unless they start practicing. And most people who run all these things don't even know what it means to practice, never mind do it. So what we are actually concerned with here is to become aware of this bodily contact of our senses and our reactions to that. Now the bodily contact of the senses, seeing something, hearing something, you know, these are the two main senses, the two senses that are most present. They are the ones that we have most contact with. We could try, we do that best outside of meditation, to become aware when we see something, what then happens. Now obviously we see with a physical aspect of our eyes. But what happens after we've seen something? Very few people in the world are aware of what happens after they've seen something. They are aware of the fact that they can see, they've got eyes to see. They're aware of the fact that sometimes they've got to see, like when they want to cross a busy street or want to drive a car and come to a traffic light, you've got to see. Or you meet somebody, you've got to look at them and try to figure out what their name is. And that's things that one knows. But other than that, we don't know a thing about our seeing. And the same goes for our hearing. We hear, and we're so used to hearing that it's part of our existence. But what happens when we hear, we would never, ever put any attention on that unless we come to a meditation course and are asked to do that. And even then, it's not all that easy. So what happens, for instance, when we hear? Let's say we're sitting here in meditation and the bell goes. So that's sound, isn't it? And what's the next thing that happens? The mind says, dreadful. Who can meditate with bells going? Or something of that nature. But that's really not what happens as far as the body is concerned. What happens as the body is concerned is all it hears is sound. The ear hasn't got a clue that that's a bell. And it also hasn't got a clue that it's dreadful. And it also hasn't got a clue that one wants to meditate. It's totally objectively hearing sound. That's all. Nothing else. Now, what happens with that sound is that a feeling arises. All sense contacts make a feeling arise. We can't avoid that. It's unavoidable. And there are only three kinds of feelings: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Now, with the neutral ones, we are not very much concerned. First of all, we don't even notice them. And secondly, they're not unpleasant. And so we don't have much truck with them. But the pleasant and the unpleasant feelings are the triggers that generate our reactions. So what happens when we hear the bell? An unpleasant feeling. And so the reaction comes about immediately. First, there is this what we call the perception, which is the labeling, which says dreadful. And then is the reaction. The reaction says, I can't meditate, this bell's going. And not only that, there'll be probably a long string of thoughts which follow up this, I can't meditate when bells are going. Thoughts might be, actually I can meditate much better at home. And maybe I should have stayed home. Or maybe I should stay in my room. My room is very hot. The heat's very unpleasant. Maybe we should have done this in winter, not in summer. So by this time, we're in the seasons because we've heard a bell ring. It happens all the time. Touch contact. Touch contact is the best example of this. Touch contact is strictly physical. And I'd like you to use these things that I'm saying as a contemplation subjects. Now, touch contact, when we sit for a while, it depends how long we're used to sitting, in one position, it becomes uncomfortable. And what happens is that there is touch contact of the knees on the ground or the feet on the legs or whatever, and it becomes uncomfortable with having touch contact and unpleasant feeling. And the label might be painful, the perception. And the reaction is, must be very unhealthy to sit like that. I wonder whoever invented that. Why don't I sit on a chair? I should have brought the chair I always use at home. I wonder whether I actually turned the stove at home. Are they going to feed my cat? Cats are really nice animals to have. It's all generated by sitting and having an unpleasant feeling. Now we're at the cat. And then we go on from the cat maybe to the vet, and from the vet to the doctor, and so on and so on. And after about 5 minutes or so, it occurs to the mind that we actually came here to meditate. And then the mind says, oh, just a minute. Start again. You know? This is the way we operate. And we all know it. And we take it for granted. But we shouldn't. We should know about it and look at it and see how absurd it is what we do with our sense contacts. Now this by no means is supposed to mean that we shouldn't have pleasant sense contacts. This is just a matter of an idea again. Buddha never said we shouldn't have pleasant sense contacts. What he's trying to tell us is, watch what happens. Neither the ear nor the eye can react. It's always happening in the mind. Mind is constantly reacting. And what it's reacting to is not actually what it sees or hears through the eye. It's reacting to the feeling which has been generated by that sense contact. Or the touched contact. That's all it's doing. And it's doing it so fast and so without pause, we're so used to it that we don't even know what it's like to be without it. And the only way we'll ever find out what it's like to be without it, if we now, in a course like this, make a concerted attempt at trying to recognize this happening and stopping it. It's not an easy thing to do. If we can even stop it once, it's a major accomplishment. And the major accomplishment lies in the fact, not that we've done it once, but in the fact that we can actually realize it can be done. Because if you've never done it before, and you may have done it before, because I always talk about it, but if we've never done it before, then the mind has an idea that it can't be done. Because it's so used to doing it. It's the most used reaction that we have. We far more react to our own sense contact then to other people. Other people are not always doing something. That's the second greatest reaction we have to other people. But the greatest reaction we have is to our own sense contacts, because they're constantly around. To be able to enter the jhanas, the Buddha says we have to be detached from our senses. No sense contact. And obviously, if we use our mindfulness outside of meditation to become aware of this sense contact and its repercussions, it will help us in the meditation to not be concerned with our sense contact, which are, in the meditation, mostly hearing, touching, and thinking. Now, we won't talk about the thinking now. I've talked about hearing and touching. The universe is never entirely quiet. If you go into a forest, it's so noisy, it's unbelievable. All the little creatures seem to be chattering away. They're all saying something. Sometimes they pipe down a bit around noon because it's either too hot or they're eating or whatever. But other than that, they're constantly saying something. Not only the birds, everything else. And the trees are always making noise. And the undergrowth is noisy. So there's never complete stillness to be found outside of ourselves. The stillness exists within ourselves. But in order to find it, we have to let go of the sense contact. So if we sit in meditation and we're bothered by hearing, whatever it may be, and you're reacting to it, it would be the natural thing to do, to react to the sound. Maybe it's not the bell, maybe it's a truck, or maybe it's somebody coughing, or whatever. And the mind immediately says, goodness, isn't it noisy here? When you find yourself reacting, go back to the experience of that sense contact. Now maybe the truck is still going, or maybe the person has stopped coughing. Doesn't matter. You know that you heard something. It was sound. And try to recognize sound from the hearing, feeling, and stopping right there. Now we can't do that just like that. We have usually have reacted already, and then go back to it once more, and then try to stop at the feeling of it that arose. And if you don't give it a name, in other words, you don't go as far as saying that the sound was awful, the mind doesn't react. It doesn't have to. So when we become aware that our physical input is constantly monitored and digested by the mind, we no longer find it so important to react. It's just a sound. Now the easiest to do is with the touch contact in the meditation. The hearing and the seeing should be done, or can be done, outside of meditation. You know, there are no musts or shoulds about this whole thing. The Buddha always said, if you want to know the truth, then you can do this or that. There are many ways of trying to find the truth. Now, the touch contact in meditation is quite an important aspect, because before we get concentrated, we do feel the discomfort of sitting. Maybe after a length of time, or maybe even after a short time. So that is the unpleasant feeling. And if we can stop the mind right then and there and not go any further by giving it a name or giving it a reaction, then we have realized what the physical input really is. Now that is not to mean that you can't move the body when it becomes uncomfortable. What it's supposed to mean is that we become aware of what we're doing and not do it automatically. Because what we usually do, everybody, is we react automatically, instinctively. It's an unpleasant feeling, we label it quickly, are not even aware of the label, and we react. We move. So instead of doing that, we go back to the whole happening and relive it again and not react. By not reacting, for instance, to the touch contact, what we need to do is to make ourselves aware of the fact it's just touch contact. It's just unpleasant feeling. It's not mine and there's no owner. And get on with the meditation. As long, as often as one can. There's no need to grit one's teeth and become most uncomfortable. It's not necessary. But it is necessary to find out how the mind reacts to the input through the physical senses and is constantly, therefore, engaged. in working them out, reacting to them, and trying to obtain the most pleasant ones. If we stay with the touch contact, which at that time is unpleasant, we are also not trying to run away from dukkha, but we're accepting it. Again, it's not to mean that one can't move in the meditation. If one moves, that's fine. But one should have understood before one moves what it is that's making one move. It's our inherent dislike of dukkha. And because we dislike dukkha, we actually dislike nature. Dukkha is the first aspect of all that exists. And the dislike of it makes it worse. If we were to accept it, it's all right. It just is. It's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. So what? But if I own the discomfort and the unpleasantness and don't like it and must have it pleasant, then of course I have to react. So not reacting and recognizing the fact that the mind is constantly engaged in getting the physical contact sorted out is a great step towards insight. And so we should use our sense contacts outside of meditation to become aware of these four aspects that happen all the time. The one that we're least aware of is usually the labeling. But having learned the labeling in meditation, one should be aware of that. One should be able to be aware of that. It's called the perception, and it is the labeling. It's giving it a name. The minute we've given it a name, we are already on the verge of, and immediately following it comes the reaction to it. When we want to become really concentrated, we've got to let all that go. But not only that, we need to learn about these physical and mental aspects. So the first thing that we're looking at today is the impermanence, which is the constant movement of the body within and also the body without, that is, the movements we make. And that this constant movement has to be. It's again the simile of the meandering brook. If it doesn't meander anymore, it's a stagnant pool. So we are exactly the same. So if things should happen to you which you don't like, remember the meandering brook. It's always moving. It's always changing. And if you happen to have things happen which you like very much, remember the meandering brook. You can't hang on to them. No way can we ever keep anything. It's all moving. It's always changing from moment to moment. Now to see that change in the body, and we will do the contemplation on the decay and also on death, it's very helpful to look at old photographs, which I've often recommended, and it is extremely helpful to imagine your own death. And this is where imagination comes in again. Now some people do imagine their own death, look at it and say, oh well, that's quite all right. Well, they haven't really seen it. They've thought it only, they haven't seen it. The next sentence very often is, it's all right for me to die, I just don't want my loved ones to die before me. There's no difference at all. Death is death. Doesn't matter. It's just as much a dislike of what we think is annihilation as it would be of ourselves. In order to imagine and visualize and really feel our own death, we need to be aware of the fact that we're thinking of it as the annihilation of this person, the self, which is a totally wrong way of looking at it, but this is why people don't like to die. Don't want to be annihilated. The same goes for wanting to be famous, well thought of, appreciated, loved. Can't stand people that don't support our ego illusion, because that's also annihilation. Annihilation of our thought, of ourselves, of the way we think of ourselves. It's all one and the same thing. The fear of death is the underlying fear that everybody deals with. Now, some people think they're afraid of other people, afraid of snakes and spiders, or men or women, or dark, or whatever they figure out they're afraid of. Most people figure out they're afraid of other people because they don't always support us. Well, why should they? They're looking for support themselves. So everybody is fighting a losing battle, and that's why nobody's really happy. Why should they be? Because they're all wanting the same thing. They all want, what shall I say, community support. Everybody's supposed to support their ego. But since everybody wants it, there's nothing left for anybody to do. So it's a totally wrong assumption how to be happy. It's a way of certainty not to be happy. But in basis, complete foundation for that, is the fear of death, physical death. The others are the fear of emotional death, which we can usually sort of clamber out of and resurrect our ego. Sometimes it takes a little longer, sometimes we can do it quickly. But physical death seems to be a total annihilation. Well, the only reason it seems to be a total annihilation is because we think there's somebody there that can be annihilated. But if we have worked with the other suggestions of contemplation that I have made, namely of recognizing that it's a mistaken view when we think of this body as me, and even if we think of this body as mine, because why should we want to have something that's constantly giving us some trouble and in the end is going to die anyway? Why should we make ourselves this unhappiness? If we have worked with that, we may get a better inkling what it means to die. You see, the fear of being dead is underlying all the endeavors everybody is making, constantly working at something to make it better, to make it look better, work better, becoming better, being better. Always some kind of insecure trying to change what is. Can we change the fact that we're going to die? That's impossible. Everybody's ever been alive is dead now, except the ones that are still here, and they're all going to die. So what can we change? If we were to accept things as they are and look at them the way they really are, we'd save ourselves a lot of trouble. We'd save ourselves a lot of work and a lot of rummaging around trying to make things different. Now, we may not even be aware of the fact that we're trying to make things different. That inner niggling feeling of not being quite contented, that is the trying to make things different.